Hello, and welcome to Player Advantage. My name is Marcus, and I am your host of this show about nothing and everything. It's been 2 weeks. That's kind of going to be, I think, the way that we're going to do this going forward is every 2 weeks we'll do an episode, just because life is weird, and that's going to kind of be the best way to do that for me going forward, at least for the foreseeable future. In that 2 weeks, though, I've done a few things, watched a few things, read a few things, and we're going to start with Yakuza 0. Yakuza 0, as some of you might figure out from the title, some of you might already know, is a prequel to the Yakuza franchise. And it's probably the best game in that series. I've still not beaten it. I know how it ends. I know everything about that game. I've just never actually beaten it for myself. And I've been putting off beating it, sort of, because I've been mostly playing through the cabaret and real estate side stories. Side stories in general, but those two are the big ones because they take up so much of the game. So, in Yakuza 0, you play as either Kazuma Kiryu, or interchangeably, rather, Kazuma Kiryu and Goro Majima, both members of the Yakuza, both cast out for different reasons, trying to make their way back into the Yakuza. In Majima's case, he's under constant surveillance. In Kiryu's case, he's kind of a free man because he technically quit before they could actually expel him. And he has this gig running real estate, which realistically he should have stuck with. But then the plot of Yakuza 1 through 6 wouldn't happen, so he has to go back to being a Yakuza at the end. But you do these, Kiryu's is called Kamurocho Real Estate Royale, where you buy up properties, invest in them, and then you fight the guys who own that territory for their stake in the territory, and you take over and get rid of the five billionaires who are controlling Kamurocho. The problem with the real estate royale is that when you get to the point in the game where I am, chapter 10, chapter 11, where the game is very rapidly approaching its conclusion, you have to wrap it up really quickly, or relatively, and it's so uninvolved. As much as I like it, it is very much, go buy these properties. Okay, come back. Invest in them. Set your payouts. Wait 10 to 15 minutes. Go back. Buy the, collect your payouts. Buy more properties. Invest. Repeat. And there were points where I just put the controller down and started listening to podcasts, just hanging out, because there was nothing to do. Eventually, I got to the point where I started running around hunting side stories. So I'm on the fifth and final area, the Media King era, which is all the hotels and everything. And while you're over there, you find the pocket arena where you're doing slot car racing. It was like little model slot cars. And so I started doing that for 20, 25 minutes just to have something to do. And that's really fun, actually. As silly as it is in this serious game about crime, to have a side story in which your serious crime man races slot cars with a bunch of children and teenagers and one dude in a ridiculous costume. If you've never seen him, go on Google right now and look up Pocket Circuit Fighter, because that man looks ridiculous. And he looks more ridiculous in Kiwami, which is the remake of Yakuza 1. He looks ridiculous because he's still dressing like that, and he's 40. like, he's a parent, and he's still dresses like that for work because he can't let go of the pocket fighting. But yeah, it's a really good game. But boy, am I ready to be done with that real estate stuff. Just been hunting the side stories in the meantime. Which reminds me, there was that interview from that producer a few years ago that I would just like to talk about briefly, about Kiryu. So a producer on the Yakuza franchise said that he, as far as he's concerned, Kiryu is a virgin. Kiryu never has never had sex. And his reasoning is that Kiryu loves Yumi from Yakuza 1 so much that she's the only woman he ever loved. And thus, he, after the end of Yakuza 1, when she's not around anymore, spoilers for a 15-year-old game, when Yumi's not around anymore, and Kiryu is raising her daughter, he goes, well, I can never be with a woman. Which, fine. That as a notion, fine. I can understand the reasoning. The problem with this idea is that in the beginning of Yakuza 1, Kiryu is in his mid-30s. Or he's in his late 20s. Because that's 1995. So he would be 27. And if you're going to tell me sincerely that you think that this man who, 27 years old, ran a real estate empire briefly, was a Yakuza, if you're going to tell me seriously that he just never knew a woman biblically, you're lying, and I don't like it. Especially considering, and granted, I think when he said this, Yakuza 0 had not come out yet. But Kiryu, in that game, there are at least two separate sub-stories in which Kiryu explicitly goes into a hotel with a woman and has a good time. And so to everyone who believes sincerely that Kazuma Kiryu does not know what sex is, I say to you, how dare you disrespect the Dragon of Dojima this way? That man fucks. This is a weird transition now, because I forgot to talk about Majima. but Majima, the cabaret stuff, is a lot more involved than the real estate, because it's basically Diner Dash, but with a cabaret club. Like, you still do the runaround buying, or in this case, you're partnering with different businesses around Sotenbori, and partnering them with your cabaret club, and then you run the cabaret for a night. And it's a 3-minute, essentially Diner Dash style mini game in which this guy wants to party with a girl who is funny. Okay, so who's got the highest party stat? Who's the funniest? All right, you go over there to that table, hang out with that guy, get him whatever he needs. Call me if you need anything. This guy wants to be loved on by a beautiful girl. Okay. Who's got the highest love stat? Who's the most beautiful? You go over there. And you do that. And then once you kind of move in on the turf of the other clubs, they challenge you to a battle where it's whoever makes the most money wins the battle. I've only done one of them so far. The first one against the owner of Club Mars. I should add that all the clubs in Sotenbori are named after heavenly bodies. So there's Club Mercury, Club Mars, Club Moon, Club Jupiter, and Club Venus. And you run Club Sunshine. And once you get to a certain level against Club Mars, the owner's like, all right, well, we're going to have a battle. And it is stressful in a way that is just a matter of UI lying to you, which is nice. Because when you're doing the fights against the five billionaires, it's just a fight, the same way you fight everybody else in the game. the way this works is you have this bar, and you have to, your bar has to exceed theirs. And what happened when I did the battle against the owner of Club Mars is that his bar starts out way higher. So I'm like, oh God, I've got to get this guy over here. I got to get, you know, get everything taken care of. And then once you start to catch up, he has an ability where he just makes people leave your club. And then you've got to overcome that. And then you start to edge past him, and then your bars end up super close. And then I ended up smoking him. But the UI lied to me in such a way where it didn't seem like I was going to, where it definitely felt like, oh man, I screwed this up. I got to load the save and do this all over again. Because if you lose the club battle, your club gets closed down. And I don't know if it just kicks you out to a game over screen or what happens. The reason it's important to do these sub stories, to do the real estate and cabaret club stuff, is because by finishing them, you unlock Kiryu and Majima's last fighting styles, the legend styles. So you unlock Kiryu's style from Yakuza 1, you unlock Majima's knife style, which both make the game a lot easier, especially on the boss fights that you're going to run into at the end of the game. Majima gets an ability with that knife style where he can just, he basically just one-hit kills most normal enemies with it. And it's just a normal move. Like, it's not a heat move. It's just one shot with his knife. And it's really good. So it's important to do these. And I've already put in what feels like 20 hours just doing this. Like, my playtime has got to be approaching 70. I feel like I've played a solid 20 just doing real estate, just doing the clubs. But Yakuza 0, $20 on the PlayStation Store. I believe now, because it's a PlayStation Hits game. And I should add, if you've ever had any interest in the Yakuza games, in that franchise at all, even like a passing interest, it's now easier than ever to play all of them, because Yakuza 0, Yakuza 1, or Yakuza Kiwami, I should say, Kiwami is the remake of 1, Kiwami 2 is a remake of 2. Those games, I believe, are all $20 now. They're all in the PlayStation Hits collection. So you pay $20, you get any of, you get them. So the price that you pay for a normal game, brand new, full price, you pay and you get all three of those games. And then I believe just this week they released, or are going to release, the remasters of 3, 4, and 5 on the PS4. I'm not sure if they're on PC yet, but I know for sure on the PS4, Yakuza 3, 4, and 5 are getting dropped. And then you've got the you've got 6. It's already out on PS4, which is, I want to say, price drop now. I want to say it's like $34.99 in the States now. So if you have any interest in those games, you should absolutely at least pick up 0 and see how you like it. Because 0 is probably the best one. And since they're remaking Kiwami, or they remade 1 and 2 in the same engine, the same style, if you like Zero, you'll like Kiwami. You'll like Kiwami too. Play Yakuza. They're really, really good game. I also tried to get caught up on some comics, most notably the Power Rangers comics, Go-Go Power Rangers and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers by Boom Studios. They had their Necessary Evil event, which is a follow-up to Shattered Grid. I understand the idea of following up to Shattered Grid after it was basically the biggest thing to happen to that franchise in what's got to be 10 years. And it's interesting. It fills some gaps, which is kind of the whole purpose of this comic, is to fill in gaps that the show couldn't have because A, it was 1993, and B, they did not have the budget to do the things that, the budget or the idea, realistically, because it's 1993 and we're making the show for 10-year-olds. We're not really making it for adults. This is more of the, like, the focus of these comics is very much people in my age range who are, you know, fans of this growing up, but except that it's for kids, and it always was for kids, even when the Rangers were adults. So it introduces a new Ranger team in the form of the Omega Rangers, who are Zach, Trini, Jason, and a new character called Kaya. This is essentially what happened when those three left the show to go to a quote-unquote peace summit, which was, in reality, the way that they were written out of the show due to a contract dispute. It was either a contract dispute or a union dispute, and Austin St. John, Thoy Trang, and Walter Jones all left Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and were replaced by Steve Cardenas as Rocky. I can't remember. I just had her name. Nakia Burris, I think is her name, who plays Aisha. And, of course, Johnny Young Bosch as Adam replaced them as the Red, Yellow, and Black Rangers, which still happens in the comic. It's just that, hey, surprise, surprise, these three were lying about what they were doing. And they're actually out in space on a secret mission from the Emissary from Shattered Grid. It introduces two new original villains and does kind of the flash-forward thing that Shattered Grid did. And it's just a really good concept as a story and as world-building, because if there was ever a story that needed more world-building, if there was ever stuff there, like there's material there needing to be fleshed out, it's Power Rangers. So the idea of, oh, we're going to a peace summit as a cover is a really good idea. And it makes it's a lot more fun than what we got back when the show was airing, which was, okay, so these three characters left, and then Jason returns as the Gold Ranger in Zeo. So two seasons later, he's back. You know, there's no, so what were you doing in, I want to say they say they're in Switzerland. What were you doing in Switzerland for the last 2 years? Because they're very rarely, if ever, mentioned in Mighty Morphin Season 3 when they get the ninja powers. They're definitely not mentioned at all in the movie. So when Jason returns, if you were someone who was not watching in Season 2, and like if you picked up after the movie came out, Jason being this big reveal as the Gold Ranger is like, who? So filling in that gap of what he was doing and what Trini and Zach were doing, because Trini and Zach never come back. They just don't. I think Zach might, actually I've got to go back and check these more recent crossover episodes where a bunch of Rangers from the past come back. I don't think he came back for that. I want to say TJ came back. Adam came back. Like a bunch of other Rangers come back, but Zach is one that just does not. He just does not return. And unfortunately, Thoy Trang passed away in 2001. So obviously, Trini wouldn't come back. But Jason returns, and so having the gap of where he was, what he was doing, having that filled in is pretty cool. And it's going to be interesting to see if something happens, the reason why Zach and Trini never come back. If they stay out in space and that's the explanation. But it's pretty cool so far. I think I'm about a third of the way through, because this event is in both GoGo and Mighty Morphin. And it's definitely something I want to keep reading. I mentioned in the first episode, I'm a big fan of these adapted comics. The Mega Man Archie comic was pretty good. The Sonic comics, at least the Ian Flynn written ones, have always been pretty good. So I think adapting things for comics is the way to go. And a lot of things are doing that. They did it with Buffy. They did it with Smallville. So after Smallville ends, there's another comic about that version of Superman. and more things should be open to doing it. Especially things like Power Rangers should be open to adapting for comic, because it's the way to go. So The Good Place wrapped up over the last couple weeks. It took me until last Thursday night to finally watch it, because I could not bring myself to do it. It's just one of those things, because of the nature of that show, it's all very final. So when you get to that ending, it's like, this is it. You know, this goes away after this. And luckily, it's a good enough show that it's something that can be rewatched forever, as long as it is available. And I think Michael Schur deserves a measure of congratulations, not just for making one of the best shows of the last decade, maybe in the history of TV, it's definitely up there, but for having the courage to end it, having the courage to let it be final after four seasons. Because lesser showrunners would have found a way to crank it out for a fifth season. You know, it's the Scrubs problem, where Scrubs ends perfectly. Scrubs has a great ending, where JD leaves the hospital and you see that montage of him and what his life will be after this, of him and Elliot getting married, of them having a kid, of that kid growing up with Turk's kid, and just of what his life will entail. And it feels very final. And then it came back for one more season, and it should not have. A lot of shows have this problem where you just drag it out for way longer than it should go. And you don't do anything, or you try too hard to make it new, and you lose sight of what made it special in the first place. How I Met Your Mother is a excellent example of this, where if that show had ended after maybe four seasons, if that show had ended 4 years in, same as The Good Place, it would have been a lot better received. The problem is, you drag out your character development over the course of, like, I'll use Barney and Robin as the example of this. So from season 6 through season 8, or season 9 is the last season of that show. Those last seasons have a lot of great character stuff for Barney and Robin. The problem is that the finale of that show undoes the character development for Barney, Robin, and Ted. That whole last season also undoes a lot of Lily's character development. It's like everyone but Marshall ends up as a weird version of their former self, and it sucks. The Good Place does not have that problem. The Good Place, by and large, because it only went four seasons, ends on such a great note, where every version of these characters, where all four of your main cast, plus Janet, plus Michael, so all six of them, they have all become the best version of themselves. Janet literally becomes the most technologically advanced Janet in existence. Where the only being more advanced than her is Derek, who has become the Singularity. And gets rebooted one more time in the last episode, so God only knows what he becomes after that. Michael gets his happy ending. He gets what he always wanted. And everyone gets to be the person that they always could have been, provided they were given the opportunity to become those people on Earth. And that's kind of the core theme of the show, is minor spoilers. At one point, someone says that people get better when they are given love and care. And that is exactly what happens. Chidi, Tahani, Eleanor, and Jason all get better because they were given love and care, both by each other, by Michael, by Janet, by the people around them. They become their best selves because of love, because of having other people around them. And it's a really good message, and it's a really, really great place for that show to leave off on, and having the courage to end it, especially when you've got a hit. That's the thing, is having the courage to end it when you've got such a great thing right there that you could probably have stretched out for another season, but it wouldn't have been as good. It wouldn't have hit the same way that this ending in four seasons does. All-Star Weekend is starting officially tomorrow for the NBA. This is my favorite. It's my favorite weekend of the year for sports, more than the finals, more than the Super Bowl. All-Star Weekend, specifically All-Star Saturday Night, it's the best. It's the best every year. And since I won't be able to continue my tradition of sitting on my couch, playing a video game, and watching the dunk contest simultaneously, I did the next best thing, which was run back the 2015 and 2016 dunk contests. Boy. Whew. What a great two events. And I understand why Zach LaVine doesn't want to do them anymore. I mean, you already won them twice. But man. Man. The stuff he did in 2015, 2016 was incredible. Especially that showdown with Gordon in 2016. And that one specifically is always a fun one to go back to, because it's so much discussion around it of did Gordon get robbed? I'm of the opinion that he did not. I think the order in which they were dunking made it seem that way, because LaVine's dunks were 50s, but they seemed less than that because they were going after the stuff Gordon was doing. Like, if the scale went up past 50, Gordon would have won. Because there were dunks he was doing that did not make any sense that a human being could do. The one where he goes up over the mascot, his legs fully extended, grabs the ball underneath himself and dunks it. Incredible. Unbelievable. But it was his last dunk that really did it, where it was the double pump, where he cocks it behind his head like he's going to do a tomahawk, brings it back down low, and then does the reverse. That was a really good dunk. I can understand why it got a 47. And LaVine did the between the legs from the free throw line. That's a 50. There's no way about that. That dunk is a 50. And that's probably the best dunk contest I've ever seen in my life as a contest, not just as a like single performance, because I think as a single performance, it's Vince Carter is way up there. That might be number one, if for nothing but nostalgia reasons. The man put his whole arm in the basket. He did a 360 windmill to start. That was his first dunk, was he did a 360 windmill. I think he got 350s. It was incredible. And if I were given a time machine, I would put Zach LaVine in it and make him go back and play and do that dunk contest in 2000 in Oakland against Vince Carter, because that would have been nuclear. That would have been insane. They would have dunked for the next 2 weeks. They would have had to put the regular season on hold until those dudes figured out who won. Speaking of Zach LaVine, it's interesting that he was essentially snubbed from the All-Star game. Didn't even make it as a reserve. And I get it, because the Bulls aren't winning a lot of games, and he's, despite how well he's playing, because he's playing 25 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists. He scored more. He's had more 40-point games this season than anyone in Bulls history except for Michael Jordan and I think Artis Gilmore. He's playing at an absurd level. Trae Young got in, and no disrespect to Trae Young, but the Hawks are a way worse team than the Bulls. Like, they are. Objectively, the Hawks are terrible. The Hawks are so bad. So the idea that LaVine didn't get in because the Bulls aren't winning a lot of games doesn't track to me, because the Bulls are only two spots out of eighth. So they could still feasibly, in a scenario where they win every game for the rest of the season, they could, in theory, make it to the playoffs. I don't think they will. But it's possible, and for Young to get in, and he absolutely deserves it, Trae Young, he's played incredibly, but for Young to get in, and for Devin Booker, who's just announced as getting in, two guys who play a very similar style to LaVine, two guys who play at a very similar level, and for both of their teams to be worse than the Bulls, it just does not add up to me. And granted, they play in different conferences. They're both in the West. But it just does not track. That being said, Devin Booker is in because Damian Lillard is out with a groin injury. And that's a big bummer for Dame. But it's also worth noting that if he's out for any length of time beyond like this weekend and maybe the first couple games after the All-Star break, then the Blazers season is in trouble because they've been fighting for a spot in the playoffs, and he has been the driving force on that team. He's the driving force in that team every year. And as good as he and CJ are, they would be done a service by getting one other player out there with them, getting one other star out there with them. Because I think both of those guys are stars, but they need one other piece if they want to make a deep playoff run, which I know that especially those two guys, two very competitive guys, they definitely want to do. But they've got they need a little help. And I don't know where that comes from, but they definitely need it. I want to go back to the Bulls briefly. The Bulls not playing very well. Their biggest problem is they can't close games. And I kind of was thinking about this while I was watching that 2016 contest. How well would they be served if they went out and got Aaron Gordon? And the answer is they'd probably be in the same spot, unfortunately. When you compare him to Lauri Markkanen, where Gordon is averaging 14 points, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, and Lauri Markkanen is putting up 15 points, 6.5 rebounds, 1.5 assists. So they do gain a little bit in that assist category, but I don't think he's the guy. But it was just a thought experiment I was doing. I think they're a team that's served best if they could have made the trade that the Heat made and went out and got Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder. I think they would be in a better position. Solomon Hill too. They're a team that definitely would have been in a much better position because they've drafted 7th the last 3 seasons. 3 years in a row, they've had the 7th pick in the draft. They picked Lauri Markkanen in 2017, they picked Wendell Carter Jr. in 2018, and they picked Coby White in 2019. They're a team that's very young. and they definitely need something. And I think the thing they need, especially if they end up at the same draft position, if they pick seventh again, then Gar Forman and John Paxson and Jim Boylan all need to be fired. Like, there's no two ways about that. If they are drafting in the same position for a fourth consecutive year, then Jerry Reinsdorf needs to look at that team and fire everybody from the front office to the coaching. Go out and get a better head coach. Go out and get a better general manager. Go out and get a better vice president, president of basketball operations. Because Bulls fans have been saying that they want Forman and Paxson out of there for years. Jimmy Butler is on record saying that he thinks that Forman and Paxson should be out of there. Then that front office is the problem with that team. And he's right. He was right about a lot of things, which I'll get into in a second. But they absolutely need to move on from Forman and Paxson and Boylan, because that triumvirate is not getting it done. You know, there's no reason the Bulls should be outscoring teams in the first three quarters and then just falling apart in the fourth. And so while I think adding a veteran presence on that team, especially in the front court, or as someone who can be there to play ahead of Coby White, they most definitely need to move on from that front office, from that coach, especially if they are in the same draft position. And it's not as though there are not coaches out there available. It's not as though there aren't former players who are out there, who are available to run that team. Jason Kidd is an assistant in LA right now. The way Frank Vogel is coaching, the way that Lakers team is running, I don't see Vogel going anywhere. So they could, in theory, just spitballing, they could reach out to Jason Kidd, see if he wants to take the head coaching job again. I can see why he'd say no, but it's an option. Ty Lue, I don't believe, is doing anything right now. Becky Hammon, the Spurs assistant coach. Like, the idea behind getting Jim Boylan was that he was an assistant for the Spurs for years. But the thing is, he's bad. So if you want to go get a former Spurs coach or someone who is from that Popovich system, you go get Becky Hammon, or you start looking at the WNBA, because there are plenty of former WNBA players who would be great in a coaching role. Just to try it out. It can't be worse than what you've got now. If you think sincerely that Cheryl Miller wouldn't be a better head coach than Jim Boylan, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you look at everything you have, because Jim Boylan is most definitely not the way you want to go. And I still don't understand why they fired Fred Hoiberg, but a change was needed, but they changed in the wrong direction, where they are in the same place they were in 3 years ago. So staying on the topic of basketball, the NBA trade deadline just passed last Thursday, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, but I want to go into more depth with it here. The Miami Heat, probably the biggest winners at the trade deadline this year. They went out and got Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder in exchange for Justice Winslow, Deion Waiters, and James Johnson. They also got Solomon Hill in that swap. And for a team that is already sitting in fourth in the Eastern Conference, to go out and add three big veteran presences in Crowder, Iguodala, and Hill, they have definitely staked their claim, I'd say. Realistically, I don't see them beating out Toronto or Milwaukee for the 2 or 1 spots, but they're definitely in a good position to beat up Boston and take that 3 spot. Especially when you've got guys who have been to the finals who have been on deep playoff runs in Butler, Iguodala, and Crowder. Iguodala and Crowder have both played in the finals before. They actually played each other in the finals back in 2018, which is a fun little wrinkle in all this. Butler has been to the playoffs a couple times before when he was in Chicago. Actually, he's been to the playoffs, I think, every season for the last 5 years, in Chicago, in Philly, in Minnesota, and now in Miami. There's no way, I think, that they move out of that 3-4 position where they are right now. I don't see them slipping lower than that, and I, with how good the Bucks and the Raptors are right now, I do not see them getting past them. Like, the Raptors have won something like their last 16 games. The Bucks have only lost like 8 games all season. So I think that those two teams have a stranglehold on those 1 and 2 spots respectively. But I think that as good as the Celtics have been, I think that you add these pieces to Miami and they're looking like the favorites, in my opinion, to overtake them. Between those two teams, I would say that Miami is definitely the better team now. And look, Andre Iguodala's exit from Miami was, or from Memphis rather, was rocky, to say the least. He had made it very clear that he was going to sit out the rest of the year if they didn't move him, that he just didn't want to be in Memphis, which is interesting to me because Memphis is looking like a playoff team. Memphis, especially with how well Ja Morant has been playing, that's a team that might grab that 8 spot and never let it go. And so a lot of those guys in Memphis were looking forward to him getting traded so that they could play him, so they could show him what they really do, what they can really do. The problem is that he got traded to Miami, who I think has already finished their season series versus the Grizzlies. So they won't get to show him what they're made of until next year. And Iggy's getting up there in age. It's unclear as to if he's going to stick around for another year. Not everybody's going to do the Vince Carter thing where they hang out until their mid-40s. You know, Vince Carter finally retiring after this season. But Iguodala might be out after this season, might be out after next year. And if he goes out with Miami, if he goes out, especially with how good that team's looking, there are definitely worse ways to leave the game behind. On the other side, the Minnesota Timberwolves traded their former star, Andrew Wiggins, to Golden State in exchange for D'Angelo Russell. D'Angelo Russell now on his 4th team in 5 seasons, something like that. He was with the Lakers, then Brooklyn, then the Warriors, now with Minnesota. But he's paired up with his friend, Karl Anthony Towns. And Karl Anthony Towns finally has a friend on his team. You know, I don't want to say what his relationship with Wiggins was, because I don't know. I don't know what those dudes do, but I know that towards the end, they were visibly not getting along on the court. So you add D'Angelo Russell, a guy who is a longtime friend of Karl Anthony Towns, a guy who Towns has in the past expressed a desire to play with, and you have a team now in the Timberwolves that might surprise a few people. I don't see them making the playoffs. I don't see them making a deep run if they do. But you see a team that is going to coexist a lot better than Timberwolves teams have the last few years. Because as good as they were when Jimmy Butler was there, Butler had that whole thing where he was very open about not really getting down with Andrew Wiggins and Wiggins' work ethic. And that led to Butler getting traded out of Minnesota and ending up in Philly. So now you've got a more cohesive locker room. And the interesting thing is Cat is a guy who has had teammates he butted heads with in Jimmy Butler, in Andrew Wiggins. And you have D'Angelo Russell, a guy who, when he left LA, when he first arrived in Brooklyn, was not really getting along with a lot of his teammates because of the way he left LA. There was that whole thing where he was recording Nick Young talking about cheating on Iggy Azalea, and that kind of gave him a reputation. And so I remember reading news stories of how it was a tough adjustment for D'Angelo Russell going to Brooklyn, how people would stop talking when he came into the room. And so now he's in a new city on a team where he has a friend. And it's interesting to see where those two guys go together, because those are two really talented guys who have not necessarily been in the best positions. Russell was on that Nets team last year that made it to the playoffs, but unfortunately, when Kyrie Irving decided to sign with Brooklyn, that meant he was out. So they did the sign and trade with him and Durant, and that was that for him in what was probably the best position he'd ever been in. And the funny thing now is that the Nets are a better team when Kyrie Irving doesn't play. So it'll be interesting to see how things work out and how this new landscape works for everybody. Birds of Prey came out this past weekend, or I should say Birds of Prey and the Emancipation of the Fantabulous Harley Quinn, I think is the original title for that movie. That title for that movie has changed and is now simply just Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey, which is interesting. It's a move they're making because the movie is underperforming. It's done $81 million worldwide, which is below sales projections, and it's just about making its budget back. The movie total, when you factor in marketing and everything, I think it was like something like $86 million to produce. So it's definitely going to make its money back. We're not looking at like a Scott Pilgrim situation where it's not going to make its money and it's not going to do the things that it needs to do to be successful. It's just not going to be as successful as Warner Brothers projected that it would be. And I've seen a lot of reasonings for this. Key among them is marketing, and that the movie was marketed weird, which kind of feels hollow, where I personally could not do anything without getting a Harley Quinn ad. But it is a movie that is anchored by you knowing who Harley is. Like, it's not Suicide Squad necessarily, where Suicide Squad was anchored by you knowing who Harley Quinn was, you knowing who the Joker was, you knowing who, hey, that's Will Smith over there, and you knowing, like, having like a cursory knowledge of the bulk of the cast. It's not a Wonder Woman situation where it's like, hey, there's Wonder Woman. It's Harley Quinn, a character who is, by and large, never been on her own. She has that animated series on the DC Universe app. I don't know how well that succeeded. I've seen basically the first episode, but not too much beyond that. But yeah, it is a lot of stuff with characters that a casual viewer of, like someone who just kind of knows what these characters exist and like has a cursory knowledge of the DC Universe stuff, would not know necessarily. Like, I'm not gonna walk up to someone on the street and go like, hey man, you know who Renee Montoya is, or the Huntress, or Cassandra Cain? These are characters that I know and that I like, but that's because I've been reading comics very intensely for the last 10 years, and I understand that the average person who's going to get up and go see a movie doesn't know them the same way. I've seen people say that the movie isn't succeeding because you can't do Harley without the Joker, which is an objective untruth. Harley hasn't been really associated with the Joker comics-wise for the last 6 years or so, and she's had her own comic runs, and they've been successful. So I don't think necessarily she needs to be tied to the Joker, especially considering that the Joker is barely in Suicide Squad. So this version of Harley, with Margot Robbie playing her, has a very loose tie to the Joker. And the version of Joker that we're probably going to see going forward with is Joaquin Phoenix's version. And those two characters, I don't think are ever going to interact. And that's fine. But the biggest thing I've seen is, well, this movie didn't do well because it's SJW trash. And there's too much politics in this movie. Which reminds me that a lot of people just think that anything that stars women or people of color, which this movie stars exclusively, like the principal cast of this movie is women and women of color. Like it's Jussie Smollett, or not Jussie Smollett, wrong Smollett, Journey Smollett, I think her name is. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Margot Robbie, and I forget the actor playing Cassandra, but it's very much a movie that is marketed towards women, that is marketed towards brown women, and a lot of people, and I'm going to leave that open-ended and let you fill in the gap there, but a lot of people think that any movie that is not pandering to them exists solely to pander. Like, they have gotten so used to being the default that when you put these other people, these other groups in media, that now it is pandering. But the fact of the matter is that anything that is marketed is pandering somehow. It is pandering to your sense of nostalgia, or it's pandering to your sense of adventure. It is literally trying to get you to consume a product. Everything is pandering. That's the way that works. But you don't think about it as pandering when you are the person who is being pandered to, because you have gotten so used to yourself being that person that you don't know anything but that. And anything but that is strange, is bizarre to you, and you just can't get down with that, because you have lived in this very insulated bubble your entire life where everything is made for you specifically. Which brings me to our last story for this week. Tim Sweeney over at Epic Games gave a talk at DICE that was quoted by IGN as saying that games shouldn't be political. Except that's technically not what he said. What he said was, or in his correction, was, if a game tackles politics, it should come from the heart of creatives and not from marketing departments seeking to capitalize on division. Which, a lot of times when people start talking about division in politics and in society, a lot of times it's games or whatever in broadly, in this case, games, shouldn't be so mean to conservatives. That's usually what these things mean. And I don't know anything about Tim Sweeney as a person. I'm not going to project anything onto him. But what I will do is take this opportunity to kind of expand upon the point I was making re the Harley Quinn stuff, which is to say, gamers, more than any group, gamers don't know what politics actually are. And if you don't believe me, go look at the reviews for Temtem on Steam. Temtem is a game about, it's essentially Pokemon. It is a Pokemon MMO made independently. And when you're making your character in Temtem, you can decide what pronouns characters will use to refer to that character. That little, extremely minor addition on the character select screen, which is, do you want to refer to as he, him, she, her, or they, them? What pronouns do you want to use? That got that game so many negative reviews that it now sits in the mixed category, and it's messed up now, because gamers have decided that anything to do with being a racial minority, anything to do with being LGBT is political, and or that it's, again, pandering. And the thing is about that is that it's not political, it's not pandering, it's reflecting reality. But it's been decided this is political. And more so than that, to my point, is that when you come out and say that your game is not political, you can put whatever you want in it. For example, Final Fantasy VII is one of the most political games of all time. It is about a giant corporation sucking the planet dry and a group of eco-terrorists trying to stop them. It is a game about the climate, essentially, about fossil fuels, about mining the planet for resources with no regard to how it affects the life on the planet. That, by its very nature, is political, but it's not. There's nothing negative about that, and the connotation of politics is that it's negative. But people are still plenty excited for Final Fantasy VII because they say, oh, well, this game's not political. People think that Metal Gear Solid, a game that features themes about the war economy and private military companies and nuclear deterrence, that those games are not political when they are. They're a game about nuclear deterrence made by a Japanese man. Made by someone from the country that was bombed with nuclear weapons. Godzilla is political. Everything is political. And if, the thing is, art is political. Every piece of quote-unquote high art has some sort of politic to it. And if video games are the art that people have been saying for years that they are, then they have to be okay with the games being quote-unquote political. And politics entails a lot more than just, oh, this game lets you pick your pronouns, which is a really minor thing, but for people who are gender non-conforming, it's probably a really nice touch. I can't speak for those people, despite having a lot of friends who are non-conforming, are non-binary. I can't speak for them, but if I was, I could probably look at that and go, hey, that's really nice that this game lets me present the way I want to and be called what I want to. It's just a nice touch. The hell, The Sims has been doing something similar for years. It's just a reflection of life. Ubisoft coming out and saying none of their games are political, and then making a game about the collapse of England post-Brexit, and no one paying any attention to it. Brilliant. Because gamers don't know what politics even actually are. That's going to do it for this episode of Player Advantage. My name is Marcus. You can give us a rating in iTunes. And if you, for some reason, want to read some of my absurd takes, you can give me a follow on Twitter at Archer Arios. That's ArxHerArios, because it with a C was taken. We'll be back here presumably in 2 weeks to talk about more stuff, whatever comes up in that time. In that time, take it easy, stay safe. We'll be back here with more of the show about nothing and everything. Have a good one.
バカみたい子供なのね、夢を追って傷ついて。 嘘が下手なくせに笑えない笑顔を見せた I love you もろくに言わない口下手でほんまに不器用なのになのにどうしてさよならは言えたダメだねダメよダメなのよあんたが好きで好きすぎてどれだけ強いお酒でも歪まない思い出Thank you.